Okay, so hello everyone. My name is Brian Reed. I'm an exchange consultant in the United Kingdom. I run my own consultancy company over there, and we're a gold partner based over there. We try and specialize in cloud consultancy, helping people develop their cloud requirements and stuff like that. And one of the things that I've been doing over the last couple of years is helping teach the Microsoft Certified Master program, which now no longer exists, unfortunately. But one of the things that we did in that was we looked at transport and some of the very advanced transport stuff. So I wanted to bring to you today a look at a bit more in-depth than the normal DLP type of stuff that you would see. Okay. So there's already been a couple of DLP presentations. Anyone been to the earlier DLP stuff? Okay. So a few things I might say might overlap, but most of it it shouldn't do. Okay. So the plan for this is to have a look at some of the components in DLP in brief, and then go off and talk about how we could take what Microsoft provide out of the box and extend it. Okay. Now this works in the SP1 version and the non-SP1, you know, so CU3, CU2, whatever, okay, versions. Okay. We'll talk briefly about the new stuff that was added in SP1, like fingerprinting. Okay. But the main aim of what we're going to look at today is we're going to take the DLP, the data loss prevention feature of 2013, and see how we can take company data that we need to restrict in some way. We need to limit, let's say rather than restrict, we need to limit the ability for that data to go somewhere, and we'll have a look at how we can use the DLP feature set to take that data, stop it, RMS protect it, transform it, do lots of things with it, whatever your business requirements are. Okay. And it's not using the sort of stuff that's in the box, which is the credit cards and the PII, the private personally identifiable information type stuff, but the ability to add your own data sets. So I've got some examples. It's based on a pharmaceutical industry, but it can work for any industry. Okay? And we'll do some demos. Okay. So DLP is composed of a bunch of things inside Exchange 2013. One slide just outlining some of those things. These work on-prem and in the cloud. Okay, my demos will be on Office 365, just because it's easier to run it on Office 365. I don't have to worry about my virtual machine playing up remotely and things like that. Okay, so I'll run them off Office 365. But everything I do in the demo and everything we talk about here can be exclusively on-prem as well. There's nothing here that's only Office 365, for example, apart from one thing I'll mention. Okay. So the main thing we're going to look at is the ability to create data classifications. What we're going to look at here is how do we define our data and say what it looks like, and then how we tell Exchange that data should be detected. That data should be detected, and in terms of detecting it, what we can do with it. Okay. So once we've defined a data classification that allows us to look for data, we create a DLP policy. And there's two ways of creating DLP policies. We can either create them manually, or if we're in the business of providing data classification and limitations of data to customers, so if it was a third-party service that we were selling or consulting on, you can create a data classification and the transport rules that do all the work, and you can package that up into one unit, and you can distribute that as a single unit. So you could take, for example, a data classification and the associated rules in a lab environment and reproduce them identically in a production environment. So rather than it being a series of different PowerShell commands, you can package it up. And from the sale or the consulting viewpoint, you could provide that, test it, make sure it works, and then take it to your customer and install it and know that it would work on that. Okay. So a DLP policy is a set of transport rules, or one or more sets of transport rules, that look for the data you've defined in the data classification and then do something with it. So for example, in the demo that's coming up later, we'll look for code words that have been put into product data sheets. So I said it's a pharmaceutical example. We've got some products. Some products have been developed. Some products have yet to be released. But they all refer to the product they're referring with a code word. And we can look up that code word. We can look up that in this case, a regular expression. We can look up that code word. And then we can say things like, OK, if the code word indicates it's a private document, RMS. If the code word indicates restricted, we block it from going outside. Or whatever. Anything you can do with transport rules, you can do with your data classification because you first of all, you found your data, and now you want to do something with it. Okay. Policy tips. Let me adjust this. So policy tips are in Outlook 2013 and OWA 2013 SP1, and they will tell you if something is happening to your data. So your email contains the data you want to stop or block or something like that. So it's a way of informing the user that when they click send, in fact they may not even be allowed to click send, but if they click send, Transport would stop it. Okay. So in Exchange 2013, not SP1, it was only going to work in Outlook 2013. Okay, so if you brought up OWA, you could click send, the email would go, it would hit transport, transport would reject it, and you'd get an NDR back. Okay, policy tips allow you to avoid the NDR by giving feedback to the user straight away. Okay, and we can customize those as well. Okay. A lot of the work in data loss prevention is done by a thing called the text extraction engine. Text extraction engine is part of transport. It's part of the categorizer components of Exchange. It's the same component that does the antivirus engine. Okay. So when an email comes into transport, it's scanned for a series of patterns. Those patterns are the DLP engine patterns, but equally, they're the stuff that the Microsoft antivirus engine finds as well. So it's the same bit of code that does that. It's actually the same bit of code that then does the indexing. So it's a deep extraction engine. It looks for the text and patterns within the text, and then marks the email and says it contains this type of data. And then my transport rules will come along and do something with that data. Okay. And then finally, we've got the ability to report and enforce. Reporting in the cloud version, in Office 365, there's graphs and charts and the ability to display nice data saying this is what happened. Okay. On premise, it will record everything to the tracking logs. And so if you've got good PowerShell skills, you can run through the tracking logs and you can find out information like how many items are blocked, which ones blocked them, and so on. So there's the event data field in the message tracking log, and it will record all this data to that as well. Okay. There we go. Right. So how do we create a DLP solution custom to a company business? A couple of ways. We either use the out-of-box templates and we do the financial stuff, such as credit cards and PII and passport numbers and things like that. We write our own, which we're going to talk about here, but I've yet to find anybody who does this. Potentially people could sell the stuff that's not built into the product. Okay? There are DLP vendors out there that sell their own products. It could be a place for them where they, rather than selling their own product entirely in their own set, they could provide the data classification data, and then you could upload that to Office 365. So you could provide a DLP service additional to out of the box as something to buy. Okay. So let's have a look at data classifications, the big chunk of the work that we need to do. Okay. So the first thing you need to do is you need to get the data that you want to block. Now you've got to know what the data's like. Okay. And what you want to do is get the data and maybe, if relevant, false positives to that data. So let's say you had some documents that you wanted to block. They were they had a certain format and a descriptive layout to them. So for example, they always had the word confidential in them. Okay. And they would be a bit over the top to say any email that had the word confidential in it should not be allowed outside. Okay. But it might be confidential and something else. Okay. And that's what your data classification is. It's a description of what you're looking for. And if you get a good set of data together that says, right, these are the documents that in my company I do not want I want DLP to detect. And then here's a set of data that might look like those documents, but I want to allow out. And really, it's a piece of math to work all this out. If, let's say, I had four documents, simple numbers, if I had four documents that I wanted to block and I found one that I didn't want to block, that's an 80% relationship. It's 4-1. Okay. And so I know if I was given any one of those five documents blindly, the chances of any one of those five being one I wanted to block, I've got an 80% chance that that's the document I want to block. Okay. The numbers will differ, but that's a number you'll need to know for your data loss prevention. You'll need to know how accurate you're going to be. Okay. So when a document is emailed, am I 80%, 70%, 100% confident that I've really found something I want to block? Okay. And then, so the idea goes, the more data you have, the more patterns you'll find. And then the idea goes that at some point you'll have a series, if this is in it and that is in it,
then I'm going to be 90% confident. But if I only find one of them, I'm going to be maybe 60% confident. And so I'm going to allow the stuff through that's only 60%, because it may not be. But when it's got both or more, I'm going to stop it. Okay. So if you take a look at the built-in stuff in DLP, if you just typed in an 8-digit number and turned on the US passport DLP block, it will not block it. Because an 8-digit number isn't necessarily a passport number. But an 8-digit number, an expiry date, and maybe the word passport, all together, you're more confident that that's going to be a hit. Okay? So if you're ever testing this and you're playing with the DLP features, then you have to do more than just type in a credit card number. You have to type in a credit card number and maybe the word Visa or MasterCard and maybe a CVV or the 3-digit number on the back. Other things that increase the confidence that the data you're looking for really is the stuff that you want to block. Okay? Then you need to create your classification rule set. So we'll come and look at that. Okay? You need to test it. So you take these documents that you've used, and you make emails out of them, and you send them through. And at the moment, in exchange, it's only data on the move. So it's going through transport and being sent. Okay? They said in the keynote on Monday, if you remember, that they plan to add this to data at rest as well. So some versions down the line, you'll be able to take the stuff we do here and run it through EWS and say, right, find me all the existing emails that also match this data. And maybe RMS protect them or delete them from the store or whatever you want to do it. EWS as well. Okay, so there's more coming down the line than just what we're looking at here. Okay, so on the screen, a couple of example documents. Probably can't really see them from here, but just the idea of these. They're very general documents, okay? And the thing that's important about my ones is I've got a product code at the top of each of them, and I'm going to use a regular expression to hunt down that product code. Okay? Obviously, the data that you would have, real data, would look different. Now, something that's really important to point out here. In Exchange 2013 SP1, they added the feature of document fingerprinting. Document fingerprinting will take a generic template and stop that template going through with additional data. So it looks at the template. This example, although these documents all look the same, what we can do here that you can't do with fingerprinting is, let's say I had a price list document, an Excel spreadsheet, and I'd put the product code in the Excel spreadsheet. So all the Excel spreadsheet had was the product codes and their prices. Okay. Well, if I build a data classification that detects the keyword, then it will find it in an Excel document that looks nothing like this. But if I did data fingerprinting, document fingerprinting, it would have to look like this document. It would have to have much more of the layout to it. So document fingerprinting is more along the lines of, let's say you fill in a form for a new customer, and it's got certain fields and a certain layout. That's where document fingerprinting is great. It's really easy to set up. But if someone scraped the data out of that document, stuck it into an email and sent it, document fingerprinting wouldn't catch it because it's now not inside that document. It's not in the layout and the form of the document you've done document fingerprinting for. But generic data classifications would block that. Okay. So you need your data, and what we're going to do is we're going to build an XML file. Okay. So this is really techy. Which you can tell by the fact that there's not so many people of you in the room. It's a really level 300 plus 400 type feature. But we need to build an XML file. We need to determine the type of rule, or the type of data we're looking for. There's two types of data we can look for. One's called affinity, and one's called entity. An entity is that data is in that document, and I can very precisely describe it. So if I go back a slide, these would be affinity. I could say, okay, I've got the product code, and near it, I've got a word such as confidential or private or something, okay? So what I'm going to do one that says code near this regular expression. Okay? It's defined data. Okay? The other one I've got is affinity rules, and these are possibly, vaguely, maybe, it might describe, given a good weather and the wind blowing in the right direction, this type of data. So, for example, affinity is good for things like Sarbanes-Oxley and other policies and legalese that describes things not precisely, but more in the general terms. So, for example, Sarbanes-Oxley and other financial type things, you might say, well, if it contains year of end report and financial data and loss, it's sort of talking financial. And there's lots of other documents that might also have those words in. It's more vague. Okay? And that's more what the affinity is like. Do I possibly describe the documents? Whereas an entity, it's here's keywords, here's regular expressions, this really is found in the document. Okay. And then we build a classification file for that. Okay. To do that, you just need some GUIDs. So you get a GUID generator, get yourself an XML editor, and put it together. Big tip for doing this, first time I tried to do this, did it in Notepad, that was a bad idea. Although you could take the XML samples that are in TechNet and paste them into Notepad, Notepad doesn't read the XML, it doesn't parse the XML, and the top row in the XML describes the format of the file. So it will say whether it's an 8-bit file or a 16-bit file. Okay? Your file type must be saved in the same format as the XML file is defined. So another good tip, if you're writing these, create them, save them, open them in IE, for example. You know, if it looks like an XML file, but it actually isn't, a typo, or the file format is wrong, you know, you've saved it in Unicode, but you've said 8-bit at the top, IE will throw an error. So it's a good, just double-click it, does it open in IE, does it appear syntactically correct? And in IE, you can collapse and expand it and stuff like that. Obviously, the real tip is to use a proper XML editor and create it. That saves a lot of problems. So in my demo, I'll do it in Visual Studio, but there are other tools that you can do this in as well. Okay. And then you need some way of defining the data, and we're going to have a look at that. And so we're going to do keywords or regular expression. Okay. So let's bring up some of the XML. Now, what I'm going to do for these slides, I'm just going to give you an idea of the structure, point out some of the important things that it needs, okay, and then we're going to have a look at some real data and a real demo. Because otherwise, just looking at slides is not so interesting. This is the general structure of the XML. It starts with a rule package. Node has an infinite rule package. And inside that, there's, in general, two things. There's the rule pack, which describes the author and the creator and the version number. So if you made an update to it, you could release a new version with an updated version number and apply that. And so you could keep track of your files, because you've got version numbers in there, publisher and description and stuff like that. Okay. And then the big chunk of the data is the rules, what you're looking for. So I'm looking for this regular expression keyword, this regular expression or that keyword. Okay. So the rules is the big chunk. Okay. So it's two defined areas, and here's the rules bit. Okay. So in the rules bit, and this is for an entity, and I've got a couple of arrows to point out the interesting stuff that goes on in this. Okay. Lots of GUIDs. Okay. And you refer to the data that you're looking for by GUID, and later on in the document, the same GUID will refer to the language description of it. So if you're a multinational company, you might want to say, Contoso Pharmaceutical Restricted Documents, you might want to have that in French and German and so on. Okay? So the way you do it, you define it once as a rule to find, and you have a GUID, and then down the bottom of the XML, you have the same GUID, and then all the different languages that you want to describe it in. Okay? So you don't need to create an XML file for every language. It's relatively easy, given the fact you have to write in a different language, it's relatively easy to localize this. Okay? In my demos, I've done some localization. I use Bing Translate. So if you can speak Hindi, it's probably wrong. Okay? Can you speak Hindi? You can, okay, well, there we go. So I picked one at random, and look, this person on the front row can speak the language I picked at random. Okay. But what will happen is if you are using OWA or Outlook and your local, your character set install, Windows version install is Hindi in this example, then it will display it in that language rather than English. Okay? And you set a default, which will be English. So if I logged on, for example, in OWA in French, and my one only had Hindi and English, it would show English. Okay. So I need a GUID to link all this localization together. Okay? I have a value that defines the proximity. This just says how far away from the thing that I found, so I found my keyword or my regular expression or whatever, how far away from the thing that I found do I look for my corroborative evidence? So in my example I had on the screen earlier, there's a regular expression and near it was the word code or product. Okay. And so I say, and so in this example, 600 characters. So it looks 600 characters either side of the thing that it's found looking for the corroborative evidence. And the more corroborative evidence we find, the more confident we are the document is something we want to block or detect. Okay. We give it a percentage confidence. Okay. So in this, there's a confidence value level of 85 for the lower arrow, and for the arrow on the left-hand side, it says a recommended confidence 65. And so in this example, it's if I find this particular pattern in the data, I'm 85% confident I found the document I want. All I need to do is exceed the recommended confidence value for the rule to hit. So in this example, it's probably a bad example. In this example, the recommended confidence is 65%. So clearly, if I hit the first pattern, I'm always going to hit 85%. So I'm always going to exceed 65%. But I'll give you another example. Let's say I had a recommended confidence of 70%, and I had a pattern at 40, and another pattern at 40. Hitting one pattern is only 40% confident, so the rule won't fire, because I haven't hit 70% confident. But if I hit both patterns, 40%, 40%, 80%, okay, so it's a way of saying I must match all of these rather than I must match one of them. Okay? It's a way of building it and making it more confident. Okay? Every pattern has an ID match. That's the anchor that we're looking for. So it's the main thing. So in this case, the ID match, in this case, says person details. So somewhere else in the document, it will define what I mean by person details. And then 600 characters either side of person details, I look for the minimum matches, the NE. So in this case, I want to look for one UK address or one name. I only have to hit one of those, either one of those, within 600 characters, and the whole pattern matches. But if I didn't hit either of those, even though I found the person details, it, person on its own is not going to work. It has to be a person plus a name or person plus a UK address. And somewhere else in the document, I'll define what that is. So if you look at the default built-in stuff and the passports, it's a passport number near the word passport or near a country or near expiry or things like that. Okay. And in this example, I need to find two names because it says min occurs two. Okay. So I can set lots of rules and conditions to the way the data is defined. Okay. And I can have lots of patterns, as I described a moment ago. Okay. So there's lots of work that you can very, very detailed describe the data that you're looking for. Okay. Here's a slide that sort of describes the picture, in picture language, how that works. Okay. So, for example, in orange at the top left, there's a UK tax number, a national insurance number. Okay. So it's detected the national insurance number, and it will look, in this case, proximity, patterns proximity, 300. It will look 300 characters either side of the keyword, the national insurance number, looking for corroborative evidence. Okay. And so, so actually the ID match, where it says AB 234567A, that's a national insurance number. And then to the left of it, it's found the words NINO. In other words, so it's a string of characters plus NINO. Oh, it must be a national insurance number. I'm much more confident I found it. So in other words, an eight-digit number near passport is going to be a passport number. Okay. And down the bottom, there's a couple of other examples for that. So what the bottom graphic shows is sometimes it's inside the window, sometimes it's not. So for example, in NINO 1, there's an address within the window. So that's going to be corroborative evidence. But if we look at national insurance number 3, name is not completely within the 300-character window. Name is on the edge of. Name starts within 300 characters but finishes outside, so it wouldn't be considered. If you wanted that to match, you'd make your pattern's proximity bigger. Okay? And that's why you need to know your data and the sort of stuff you're looking for. Okay. All right. Now, the next one's a bit of more complicated maths. But it's the formula, you can pull this out of TechNet, it's the formula that shows how you calculate the collective percentages of reliability that you found some data. Okay? If you are more interested in the maths, then if you get the slide deck and download it, it's in the notes. Okay? So I'm not really going to talk about it, just for your reference, if this is something you're going to do in the future, come back to the slide deck and have a look at the math behind it. Okay? But it basically says, you know, if one pattern was 40%, and another pattern was 40%, and I found both of them, it's basically 40% times 40%. I don't think that is 80%, but it might be 80%. But what happens if it was 40% or 30%? You know, so the math just times them together. So for example, if I had something that was 85% on its own, it's going to be 85% confident. But if I had something that was 85 and 65, it comes in as something like 97% confident. Okay? So it's the combined values of confidence. The other data type that we've got is affinity. Okay. And this is the one I said is a bit more vague. It's more like the possible keywords and words. Okay. And so in this example, we're looking for a lot of the similar sort of stuff. Again, we have a GUID and we have a proximity value, so it's within 600 characters. Okay. It's defined as an affinity up at the top rather than an entity. Okay? And we have a confidence level. And again, we have to, if we hit this pattern, we're 40%, in this case, 40% confident we found it. But if we hit multiple patterns, we multiply the confidences up to find the data we're looking for. But in this, there's no anchoring keyword. There's just a series of patterns to match. So in the entity, in the entity, there was a keyword that you looked for, there was an item you looked for, and stuff around it. In affinity, it's really a moving window. It slides its way through the data set, and it's looking for these patterns. If it finds multiples of these patterns, so in this case, it finds two, but no more than two, in this example, within a 600-character window. So find a 600-character window, do I find two of them? If I find one, it didn't match. If I find three of them, it didn't match. Okay. And that 600-character window slides through. Okay. Just flick through those. Okay. So the proximity window, in this example, proximity window of 600 characters, has found three different evidences. An SEC filing, draft, and a financial year type date structure. Okay. But if I carry on and move this one through the data set, a different 600-character window actually only finds two of them, okay? Because draft is slightly outside of this window. Okay? So in this example here, it's 78.4% confident that I found those, because it's 3 times 40%. Actually, that should be inside. Okay? All right. And so you multiply your confidence level values together, and you can come up with this number. And so in that previous slide, if I wanted to make sure that documents with all those words in were matched, but documents with some of those words in weren't, I'd be looking for something in the high 80s confident. Okay. All right. Then down the bottom of the XML, you then have to define actually what you're looking for. Okay. So all we said at the top is the pattern you're looking for. We haven't actually said what that pattern looks like. Okay. So down the bottom of the XML, you define what the pattern looks like. And there's two things to do. There's either keywords or regular expression. Okay. And so this is a keyword entity. So up in the top, in the entity or the affinity, you have a value. And that word, in this case, KW credit card, exists somewhere further down. Okay. So down the bottom of the document, KW credit card will exist again. And in this one, it's a word match. Okay. So it's looking for either CVV or CVC2. So it's the three-digit number on the back of your credit card. Okay. So find either one of those two, and then the KW credit card keyword has matched. Okay. Now, in this, it's a word match. So it has to be a word. In other words, it has to be at the start or the end of a sentence or have a space in front or at the end of it. You can do string matches. And a string match is just those characters anywhere. Okay. So, for example, if I looked for the word apple, okay, but I had an email with the word toffee apple in, English word probably, I've probably confused all of you by referring to words that you don't understand, there we go, an English one, toffee apple would not match, because the word apple is inside the word toffee apple, okay, whereas apple on its own would match. Okay. So it's words rather than strings. Okay. Okay. And then the regular expression, again, same thing, somewhere up in the entity or affinity you have an ID reference, so in this case PH Contoso, and we're looking for one of RX REST or RX PRIV, okay, two words that I use to define the data pattern that I'm looking for. And then down the bottom, I have a regex, RX REST, and RX PRIV. And I can be very complicated on my regular expressions. Obviously, regular expressions take more CPU cycles than word and string matches. Okay, so if you can define it as a word or string, great. But if you can't define it as a word or string, write some regular expression. There's lots of regular expression editors available online to help you put a pattern together. Now, I'm not going to explain this one, but in brief, it's a bunch of letters, a bunch of numbers, and a bunch of letters. Okay? And it finds them. And if you find that pattern, and I'll use this one in the demo. Okay? And there's two examples here. There's one that ends E, G, or K, and that one I will say is a restricted keyword, a restricted regular expression. And the one that ends in P, the rest is all the same, the one that ends in P is private. Now, by defining two types of pattern to look for, two types of entity to look for, two types of data to look for, I can now write transport rules that do different things. So I could say, right, well, if you find the restricted one, stop it from going outside. But if you find the private one, allow it outside, but put RMS protection on it. Okay? Because they're different types of data, I can therefore do different things with them. And then the last few things that we need to put together for this, the localization bit, so we talked about that briefly earlier. Again, we said this is all reference to the GUID. Okay, so at the top of the document, we have a GUID, and then further down in the localized area, we have the same GUID. And then we just basically have a name, and we have as many names as we need. That's the name of the data set, and then a description for the data set. So if I had 10 languages, I'd have 10 rows that were name, followed by 10 descriptions. Okay. One of those will have default is true. Okay. Only one. All the rest would not. But all of them will have a language code. So for example, here would be name, language code is GB, default true, and then I'd have the entity name in English. The next row may say language code German, but not default. And then I would have the name in German, and so on. Okay.
Is the pattern the same for different localizations, or are there also different patterns?
So the question is the pattern the same for different localizations? Okay. No, I don't think so. So if this pattern turned up, the localization is just to display what localization has been found. Okay. So if you had a different set of keywords in one country from a different country, you'd have to define both. What you might do is say, well, these are the keywords that only turn up in France. So you might say default French or French default true, because okay? It's only ever really going to turn up in France. And then at a different XML file or maybe the same XML file, you define the pattern you already have in Germany. And you might say language code is German, is default is true. Okay? But you equally might say, well, English is the default for everything, and you'd have a French row and a German row. Okay? And then if someone in France took German data and tried to email it, it would still stop them, because you said this data, doesn't matter what country the person's in who's sending it, it's the data is sacrament. Okay. All right. Okay. And then right back up the top, you have stuff that describes the XML file itself, so version numbers, publisher, issuing data, and stuff like this. A good way of keeping track on your files if you make edits to them and re-release them. You know, so you've sold them to customers or you've deployed them at a customer, and they're like, you can say, what version have you got? Oh, I've got version 1.2. Ah, okay, you need version 1.3. And it's an easy way of keeping track of the files and stuff like that. And that defines the information as well. And also, if you go get data classification in PowerShell, it will display this information for you as well. Okay, so let's pop over to my now suspended laptop. Log in there, okay, and have a look at an example that follows that entity one relatively simply. Okay, so done this in Visual Studio. So in this example, it's got an XML header, UTF-16 at the top. Visual Studio will save that in double byte character format. If I did this in Notepad, it wouldn't. Okay, so use a proper XML editor. Okay. And at the top of the file, we have the rule pack, as we had in the slide a moment ago, so version numbers and so on. If you make multiple files, keep the publisher GUI the same on all of them. It ties all of the different XML files you've made back to you. Okay. And then there's just name and description and so on for the publisher. Okay. So that's just generic information that you'd need to put at the top. Okay. Then you have the chunk, the big chunk of the data, the rules. Okay. In this one, it's got two different entities. Let's expand one of them. And this one's going to look for 300 characters. And it's, in this case, it's Contoso Pharma restricted. So down in the regex, which we can see down the bottom, I've got a regex Contoso Pharma restricted value as well. Okay. So this entity says, right, if you find that data type, and down the bottom, I've got the definition of that data type. Okay. And if I match it once, and within it, or near it, in fact, by 300 characters, I also find the KW product code data type, okay, then I'm going to be 85% confident that I've got a hit on my data. Okay. There's the keyword one. Okay. And in this case, it's the same as the one we had in the slide. A couple of terms, and all I have to do is match one of those in terms of a word. Okay. There is, but I've found no documentation on it, so I don't actually know how it works. There is a dictionary value as well. You can write a dictionary, and you must be able to refer to some external file. And the idea goes, or at least as far as the technical help goes, you would refer to a dictionary, and that means you could change the keyword list on the fly. So rather than having to unload the XML, remove the data classification, if you take the data classification out of Exchange, you also have to take away the policy rules and the transfer rules first. So you're undoing a lot of stuff to update the XML. But the dictionary value rather than the word refers to an external file. Okay? Now, I say I haven't got this working and there's no real help on it. But if it is as it is described, I guess it's along the lines of if you wanted to add new keywords, you just add them to this file and save them. You might have to restart transport, you might not. Okay, but that would allow you to have a system whereby you could change the data types over different days and weeks and whatever quite easily. Okay, and in this example, I've got two different entities. The other one is for the private data set. Okay. And then down in my XML, I've got my regular expression. Okay. So in one of my, where are we? I've got a regular expression website. Okay. This is regexr.com. There's lots of them out there. Okay. And in this example, you just paste in the regular expression that you want, or you can build it on the fly, and it works it out. And in the text area, you type in the document that you're looking for. So in this particular example, I've just copied and pasted one of my document types. And you'll notice it's found one instance, one match of that regular expression. But let's say this was a different keyword. Let's say it was BBB at the start. No, that's not typing there. Different character there. It's not going to find that. Okay. So I can use regular expression to test what's going on. Okay. All right. Let's pop back. Once you've got your data classification XML file written, it's time to import it into Exchange. Now, there's a couple of ways of doing that. Okay? You can either import the XML file as is that we've just seen, okay? And then once you've imported the data classification, you can then go and write transport rules or data policies, DLP policies to match. Okay? If you want to package the data classification and the rules that go with it all together, okay, then you can import all that as one entity, and we'll come back and look at that later on. Okay. But there's the new data class, the new classification rule collection PowerShell command, and you can upload the classification. Okay. It will do all the XML checks and so on. So if it's invalid XML, it won't import it and things like that. Okay. And then you can go get data classification, and it should return all your data classifications, including all the built-in ones, the Microsoft ones for all the credit cards and so on, and it should return your one in the list as well. Okay. Once you've got your data classification in, you can create your DLP policy. Your DLP policy is a collection of transport rules that look for that data classification. Okay. So in this particular example here, and it's you know, at the bottom, it's just a transport rule. You know, if the sender is a member of, that's a transport rule condition, you know, and the recipient is outside the organization, and the message contains, and that's the important bit for this, when you're creating a transport rule that is a DLP transport rule, you look for a data classification type. So you would say, okay, if the email comes from research and is going outside the organization and contains Contoso-restricted pharmaceutical content, then, and you have your conditions and your actions on that. Okay. Additionally, with the data classification, you can set what level of confidence you want. Now, we know the XML has a confidence level value in it. So if you know the XML says, right, well, if I find that document, I'm 50% confident I've got it. In the transport rule, I could say, well, you've got to be 80% confident. In other words, I've got to find it multiple times, or I've got to find more than one match for more than one data type. Okay. And so you set all these confidence levels up, and once you exceed the confidence level, the rule will fire. Okay. Of course, with DLP, the rule doesn't have to fire and actually work straight away. You can have DLP rules in enforce mode, where they really do work. But by default, when you create a DLP rule, it's in audit mode. It just records it to the tracking logs or to the GUI display in Office 365. But once you put it in enforce mode, it will stop the user sending the email, or it will enforce the action in the transport rule. And so in this example, it's going to set a header and allow it to be overridden. And in the second row, if the recipient is outside the organization, then notify the sender of the policy tip and block the message. Okay, so that's the transport rule action that causes a prompt to appear in OWA in SP1 or Outlook in Just Exchange 2013. And you create a series of different rules. If you look at DLP out of the box and you add the DLP policy for a financial passport control or financial data, you tend to find there's five rules always created. There's a rule to allow override. There's a rule for low count. There's a rule for high count. There's a rule for, there's one more I can't remember off the top of my head, and then there's one if the if the item wasn't indexable. Okay. So there's five categories, and obviously you can customize those and change them as you wish. Okay. Once you've got your rules ready, you go and create those, okay, and then you've got, there's one problem you've got. You might have done all this in a test environment. You now have to take that data from the test environment to the production environment. Okay. That means taking your classification XML, that's fine. You can take your classification XML file and upload it. That's going to be exactly the same, as long as you haven't changed it. But you've now got to go and create those individual transport rules again. Okay. Well, if you know what those transport rules are, rather than just uploading a classification file and creating some transport rules by hand, you can create a DLP policy, a bigger XML file. It contains the classification data, and it contains the rules that you're going to run. Okay. Now, the TechNet documentation on this is entirely inaccurate and doesn't work at all. Okay. I've got a blog post on how to make it actually work, and I've got the link coming up in a slide in a moment. Okay. What you can do with that is you can take that data, you can upload it. Okay. Now, when you upload it, you can you upload it via PowerShell, remote PowerShell. If you upload it into on-premises, it works. Okay. If you upload it into Office 365, it claims it's failed. Okay. Well, you wait about 10 seconds, and then you have a look to see what it did, and you find it usually finds it worked. Okay. If it doesn't, you run it again, and then it does work. Okay. There's a timing issue with Azure Active Directory. Because you're uploading the data classification and you're running a bunch of rules, it has this habit of creating them on different domain controllers in Azure. And now it replicates fairly quickly, but not quick enough for this script to run. Okay. And there's no way you can do in uploading it to Azure Active Directory. You can't say which domain controller to run it on. Do it on-premise, you can. So you can do this on-premise and say, right, upload this and put it into that domain controller. And then the timing issue is not a problem. But in the cloud, there are timing issues, and you just run it again, and it probably all sorts itself out. That's what I'm going to do in the demo, actually. Okay. All right. So you import your data classification, and then you create your new DLP policy and your new transport rules. And they're all the components of the uploaded DLP policy. Or, of course, you can create them all by hand. You can create them all in the GUI. Okay. Lots of ways of doing it. How do you create them? Well, in the GUI, you go into ECP, and you go into compliance, data loss prevention. Okay. You can go into mail flow and rules and create them there. Okay. And when you create them in there, you can tie them all up together as a single set of rules all related to the same DLP policy. Or you can just create one-off rules that look for data, not necessarily policy rules, but they use the look for data type stuff. Okay. So there's a lot of different ways of doing it. And of course, you can do it all with PowerShell as well. Okay. You obviously want to be able to back this up in case you have to restore it somewhere else or take it to another customer or things like that in a consulting environment. Okay. You can back up your DLP policies with export DLP policy collection. Okay. And if you import them, it overwrites them. Okay. So if you want to change them, you back them up, and you import them again, it will overwrite anything that was there. Okay. So you want to back them up before you import them. Okay. And if you want to back up your data classification, just keep a copy of the XML file because you can't extract it again from Exchange. So you take the XML file that you uploaded. Okay. All right. So how do we extend DLP for our private data? Let's have a pop back to my demo and show you some of this working. Okay. So what I've got here, I've got Outlook, and I've got Outlook connected for a user. And I'm going to write an email, and I'm going to put some of my private data into it. Okay. First thing I want to show you, I'm going to bring up the registry editor. Okay. And the registry editor, there's a registry key in the registry called policy nudges. And the policy nudges registry key is where Outlook records the fact that it has recently downloaded the DLP definition. Okay. And it records it with a timestamp. Okay. So Outlook will only download once every 24 hours the DLP policy definition. So that's great for real life. You don't want it downloaded too often. But it's a pain for doing demos. Okay. So I just want to show you here, that's currently empty. Okay. It hasn't downloaded any DLP policy. In fact, I haven't got any DLP policy set. Okay. And if I create a new email and send that outside the organization, for example, and let's add an item. Let's go and find a bunch of folders. There we go. There's a file that I want to restrict. And I can drop that one in. Okay. Secret number one. I'm going to send that, and it lets me send it. I haven't uploaded my data classification. I've got nothing stopping anybody sending that data out to the real wide world. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, I've got Ian's login over here, but it'll probably take a few seconds for that to arrive. But we'll come back to this later and we'll see that the email successfully arrives. Right. What I'm going to do is I'm going to upload my data classification. I'm going to do it in PowerShell. And let's grab my string for doing that. Okay. So it's import DLP policy collection and the XML file. Okay. That takes a few seconds. Do I want to do that? Yes, I do. Okay. And I'm probably going to get an error back when I'm finished with this. There's both of them. So there's. Let's see how we do. Give that a second or two. Okay. It's grabbing all the XML, it's validating it, and it's uploading it to my Exchange server. In this case, it's uploading it to the cloud, Office 365, but it could be your on-premise servers as well. Okay. And when I'm finished with this, when this comes back, there we go. Okay. I can do things like get data classification. I'm quite impressed that when I tried to do it in real, I didn't get any errors. Every time I rehearsed this, I got lots of errors, so I'm quite happy. Okay. And down the bottom, I've got my get data classification. Down the bottom, I've got my Contoso Pharmaceutical Private and my Contoso Pharmaceutical Restricted. Okay. And their description in English and a publisher name. And that's all data that came out of the XML file. Okay. I've also got transport rules. And it added some transport rules for me. What I forgot to do was show you beforehand that they actually weren't there. I meant to show you before I actually uploaded them that these weren't there before I started. Whoops, missed that one. Anyway, please take my word for it. They weren't there before I uploaded them. Okay. So I've got the first one was there anyway, so ignore the first one. But notify if it contains the Contoso pharmaceutical stuff, and then there's the restricted rule, and there's the private DLP rule. Okay. If I pop over to the DLP window, then just refresh that. There's no DLP policies configured at the moment because that's how it was before I uploaded it. Just refresh that window. There we go. There's the Contoso Pharma one that was created by the upload. Okay. And if I double-click this, it will show me the three rules that are part of this. Okay. Currently, the state is enabled, and it's in enforcing mode, and it's got three rules. Okay. So notify the user if any Contoso pharmaceutical document is found in there. So, for example, if I double-click this, it will say, it will have the notify sender, and it will say the data type is Contoso pharmaceutical private content or Contoso pharmaceutical restricted content. And to notify the sender, but allow them to send. So in this case, I'm not going to restrict them. At this point, I'm going to allow them to send it. But if it's a restricted data type, specifically, if it's Contoso pharmaceutical restricted data, I'm going to block it. Okay. And if I click that link, it's where I say the number it contains. So all I have to do is find one of those regular expressions in the document, one as a minimum and any as a maximum, and it will block it. Okay. Leave the page. And then the other one, the private one, and in this environment I've got RMS already configured using Windows Azure Rights Management. And that's all set up in there. And so I can say, and in this case I've applied the Do Not Forward, the simplest of the transport rules, but I could pick a different RMS template, and obviously, so I could say, yes, a MCM Hybrid, which is the tenant name, MCM Hybrid Company Confidential. Okay. And so I could apply that. So I could let you send it out, but you'd only read it if you were a part of this tenant. Okay. I'm going to leave on Do Not Forward, because then anybody can read it, but you'll be able to see that the template has been applied. Okay. So, policy's in place. I'm just going to pop back to the red stream. We see the policy nudges. There's nothing there. I'm going to pop back to Outlook. Okay. And I'm just going to open a new email and compose it. Now, it's the point of composing that it downloads the new definition. I think I need to restart Outlook for that to take effect. So, let's just cancel that email for the moment. And restart Outlook and pick the right mailbox. And Outlook will try and connect. And I'll just give it a second, wait for it to connect. There we go, updated, connected. Back in the registry editor, no changes there. But if I try and compose a new email, Nothing yet. Secret stuff number two. And just go and find something I want to block. There we go. And great, that's not downloading anything at all. I should have downloaded my policy tip type. Right. So, like the keynote demo, it hasn't worked properly, but there we go. What's going to happen, and this is just the policy tips, so I don't mind so much. Transport is not dependent on the download of the XML file to Outlook to make Outlook work. Okay. So if I click send, this will get protected. It will get enforced. Okay? So I'll just click send at that point. And if it's blocked, I'll either get an NDR back. Okay? If it's not blocked, it will go to the recipient, and the recipient will it'll be RMS protected. Okay? There we go. This one's come back. Okay? This email contains restricted content, and you're not allowed to send it outside the organization. Now, that's the policy tip I would have got if Outlook had downloaded my policy tips. It was doing it in my rehearsals, but there we go. Okay. Outlook will download once every 24 hours, and the existence of that registry key should control that. So the fact the registry key was missing, it should have actually downloaded it, but no matter, it didn't. Okay. So that's that document. I can't send that outside the company. Okay. But on the other hand, let's try another email. So again, somebody external. Okay. And there's a nice tip you can do in Outlook. If you come across mail tips, where you can say external and notify for external senders. That's a nice thing to turn on when you've got DLP rules turned on for external senders. So you've got DLP rule, you notify that they're outside, because the rule is only going to fire if they're outside. Okay. So you can get Outlook to put the mail tip on as well. Let's do secret stuff number three. And just have a look at my notes briefly. I need to send the price list. So let's go and find the retail price list. There it is. Okay. Now the retail price list, I'm going to send it to myself as well. Okay. So the retail price list contains both restricted and private data. Okay. So because it contains restricted data, it's not going to get sent out to Ian because he's external. And I'll get an NDR back for that. But because it contains private data, it will get sent internally, but it will get RMS protected. Okay. Or should have done, it didn't. Oh well. Let me send one from Ian. Send one to myself. I think I've got it all set up on Ian as well, but I can't remember. Let's try the retail pricing. No, insert. No, that's not kicking in either. Oh, well, there we go.
So wouldn't log be able to tell you that you are trying to send this info, although you don't see it on your Outlook tip, but the transport rule would have already caught it, right?
Yes. So if just because I don't get a notification in Outlook because the policy tips aren't downloading, transport will fire. Okay? So, for example, we talked earlier about the policy tips downloading once every 24 hours. For example, if you make changes within that 24-hour period, they will instantly kick in, or as soon as Active Directory replication fires, they will instantly kick in, and they will stop users sending that data. It could be another 24 hours before Outlook users are actually notified of those changes, but they will get blocked immediately. Okay? So it doesn't matter that I'm not getting policy tips. It's nice to get a policy tip, but it doesn't matter that I don't get a policy tip. But it will enforce straight away, and it will block if I try and send something. Okay. So let's go back to Outlook and just try sending one to Ian. Send another one. And for example, I could send it as a PDF or I could send it as a Excel. It doesn't matter. As long as the iFilters are installed or the Fast Engine's got the indexing types to match that, that would work. Okay. So, for example, if I open up, let's see, there's a good one. There's a OneNote down the bottom. OneNote filters by default are not installed unless you install the filter pack. So the OneNote wouldn't get caught because the iFilter wasn't there. If you had people regularly with the existence of OneNote or other document types, you'd need to make sure the iFilters are there to find that data in that data set. Okay. So, for example, this data type would be blocked because it's got an E at the end, and knock me out, I'm ill. That's another one. Okay. Let's drop that one in there. And no. Let's see. I've forgotten completely which one I wanted to use the demo. Oops. One of these ends in P. Oh, there you go. I don't need smoke patches. Those ones end in P. So if I take the, where's it gone? I don't need to smoke that one there. So if I send that one to Ian, because that one ends in P and it has the radical expression part of it, then that will get RMS protection associated with it, whereas all the others would get blocked. Okay. So secret 4 is not allowed because it was a restricted document, whereas let's go and have a look at Ian's mail and see if. So that one came through. I'll give it a second to see if the rest comes through. Okay. Okay, that one's taking a bit of time to come through, but we'll come back to that when it comes through, maybe. Okay. Oh, there it is. There we go. And so the last one, once it came through, finally, we can see it's got the RMS protection on it. Okay. So because this data type, or the document, because this document contained a regular expression that ended in P, was my, the data type I put in, and it was near the word code, then it found the data classification that I had. And because it found the data classification that I had, it fired the transport rule for private, and the transport rule for private said do not forward. Okay. So we can find it, if I open it up in here, the forward function should be turned off. And I'm able to restrict the ability to view documents and forward them and so on. Okay. Okay. So there's to open that, I'd have to have the rights to do that, and obviously that's an RMS demo. So I could open that and log into Office 365 as Ian, and I'd get the rights to view the document. I'll be able to see the document, but I wouldn't be able to forward it. Okay. And in this particular example, it's using Windows Azure Rights Management, which allows me to send rights-protected content to other tenants in Office 365 and beyond. That's a different subject entirely, and someone else was talking about that during the week. Okay. So to summarize, We've got the ability to create XML, to define our documents. Probably the hardest thing in doing this the first time around is getting the XML right from experience. Okay? The second hardest thing to get right in this is probably defining the data. Okay? Getting a good collective set of the data that represents what the company wants to block or restrict in some way, and then finding a pattern or patterns that define that data. Okay? If it's a form that is always filled in, document fingerprinting is great for that. Okay? But document fingerprinting falls down when the data has been scraped out of the form and just sent. You know? So for example, if you had a purchase order ledger type form and it had a credit card written down on it, okay, and someone took that PDF and put it into an email and sent it, you could block it. But if someone, and that was all typed into a CRM system or a database or something, if someone took an export of the database and hundreds of credit cards, just numbers of credit card numbers, that would get sent out. Okay. And so where the data classification wins is that you can block the data based on the patterns found in the data rather than the pattern or the structure of the form. But both are important. Okay. And equally to summarize, we can do this online in Office 365. We can do it on-premise. Okay. Obviously, we need Exchange 2013 to do it. It's Exchange 2013 Transport that does it. Okay. It's available to you if you buy EOP standalone on a volume license, because EOP standalone includes DLP as well. You don't get the policy tips, because EOP standalone, it's EOP that does the DLP for you, and there's no link between EOP and your Active Directory to store the XML file. So you don't get the policy tips, but you do get the blocking outbound as you route your mail out through EOP. Okay. But if you're on-premise, mixed mode, 2007, 2010, and 2013, it works for you as well, as long as you route your mail out through 2013. It doesn't matter if the mail started on a 10 or a 7 mailbox. As long as it leaves the organization, or as long as at some point it hits a 2013 box, 2013 Transport will examine it and NDR it if necessary. Okay. So although it's sold as a 2013 feature, you can turn it on even though you're still in the middle of moving to 2013 as well. Okay. All right. Any questions to finish? There's lots to it. The website, if you download it from the IAM Mech site as well, has a couple of links to these samples, so you can get hands on these samples and play with them and make use of them. So the samples will show you a lot more as well, allow you to tweak them. Okay. Fine. Good. Pleasure. Okay. Have a safe flight home, because this is the last session, isn't it? So had a good day? A good week? Yeah. Tiring. Yeah, it's tiring, isn't it? But yes. Okay. All right. Well, all the best, and thank you for coming along and fill in your evaluations. As there's only four of you left, it'll probably matter as well when there's lots of people it matters left. Or five of you, sorry, gentlemen in the back, my apologies. Sorry. Okay, thanks so much, and good night.